Welcome to Shorties, a short true crime story. Hello, happy Thursday.
Happy Thursday. So what do you have for me today?
I've got a story, a Bay Area story, actually.
Oh, okay, love that. Both Bay Area girls.
Yep. Okay, so it's May 27th, 2011, and we are at a Kaiser Permanente hospital in Hayward, California. 26-year-old Michelle Lay is a nursing student on shift that evening, but hours before she was due to go home, she disappeared. Security footage of the hospital shows Michelle in her scrubs, calmly but kind of hurriedly exiting the building and walking across an enclosed footbridge into the parking garage where her car was. The video was time-stamped as 6:55 p.m., Michelle is seen walking across the mostly empty parking garage towards her vehicle, which is out of sight. Because the security camera above her car wasn't working, we don't know what happened when she arrived at her vehicle. The next thing we know, her white Honda CR-V is seen exiting the parking garage at 7:17 p.m. So what happened in those 22 minutes is unknown. It doesn't take long for Michelle's nursing instructor to notice that she's gone. This was highly unusual for Michelle, and the instructor was understandably frustrated. But after looking in the break room, she realizes that Michelle's belongings were still there in her locker. It was just that her phone and car keys were the only things missing. So the instructor grabs a security guard and they go to the garage to look for Michelle together. Security footage shows them crossing the same footbridge and entering the garage at 8:56 p.m. They spend about 5 minutes going floor to floor looking for her car, but it's just not there. They head back up to the third floor where the footbridge meets the hospital and stand there for about a minute discussing what to do next. While they're standing there, security footage then shows Michelle's vehicle return to the parking lot and enter the third floor at 9:06 p.m. When the instructor sees it, she flags it down and begins walking towards it. The driver was in the midst of parking the car, but then frantically backs up and peels out of there. Security footage on the ground level shows the car careening out of the exit so fast and so recklessly, it almost hit the wall. The instructor and security guard are totally dumbfounded and immediately call 911. The following day, the nursing instructor contacts Michelle's brother, Michael, in San Diego to inform him of what happened the night before. He starts calling and texting her, but she doesn't respond. So he starts asking around to their friends and family, you know, has anyone talked to Michelle today? She had had plans to go out of town that weekend with friends, and she was a Libra, which means she was always socializing and going on adventures. So initially, her family just assumed that she was probably innocently, but annoyingly, in her own world, not really realizing that anyone was worried about her.
That is a Libra behavior.
Yeah, very much so. Michelle's phone was receiving literally hundreds of texts and phone calls from her loved ones, but no one could get through to her, because her phone was completely off. At 9:30 a.m., police locate Michelle's car. There didn't appear to be any damage or signs of foul play, but it was parked in a guest spot at an apartment complex about half a mile from the hospital that she was last seen, which doesn't make any sense because as far as her friends and family are aware, Michelle has no connection to this property. So now they're starting to get worried, and word has spread quickly amongst her loved ones. It seems like everyone who knew Michelle was now blowing up her phone, demanding that she let them know that she was okay. And then around noon that same day, one of Michelle's family members finally hears from her in a text that read, quote, "I am not missing. My phone has been acting crazy. It deleted everything. All these texts have killed my battery." And then one by one, everyone who had reached out to her began receiving text messages from her, reassuring them that she was okay. She said that she had had a bad night and she needed some space from everyone in order to rest. And this struck several of her loved ones as odd because this wasn't like her. And they expected her to call and communicate that she was okay, not send dismissive text. But the first person to really catch on to something being off was an ex-boyfriend of Michelle's. He and Michelle weren't dating anymore, but they were on great terms and close friends still. So close, in fact, that he was actually one of the first people to reach out and ask if she was okay when he had heard about what happened the night before at work. Michelle would have known exactly who he was and no doubt had his phone number memorized. But he was the only person who received a text response from her that morning that simply read, "Who is this?" When her family hears about this, they all know immediately it isn't Michelle who is sending these messages, which means Michelle is legitimately missing. Several family members pack up their cars and make the 8-hour drive from San Diego to the Bay Area that same day. As they're traveling, Michelle's phone sent one final text message that read, "I'm sick," and then her phone was immediately shut off. A few days go by with no word from Michelle or whoever it is that has her phone. And then police inform her family that after completing the forensic processing of her car, they are now viewing this not as a missing persons case, but actually a homicide investigation. So as if this isn't devastating enough, police refuse to tell her family why they came to this conclusion. So all her family knows is that when police saw the car initially, they didn't see anything suspicious. Yet whatever the forensics revealed, it left authorities confident that she had actually been murdered. So this was obviously an infuriating position for her family to be in, and they weren't content to just sit in the dark until authorities decided to share more, because that day could potentially never come if her case just remains open.
Yeah, they need answers.
So they hired a private investigator. They reached out to NBC and pushed for them to cover Michelle's case on Dateline, which they did. That's actually how I got most of this information, was from a Dateline episode. And they coordinated a huge public vigil that had hundreds of people attending and extensive media coverage. And they also partnered with Mark Klass, who founded the Klass Kids Foundation in the Bay Area. Mark's 12-year-old daughter, Polly, was murdered in 1993, which led to Mark founding this organization in her memory. Klass Kids provides support to families of missing children, and they regularly coordinate civilian search groups, which is what Michelle's family needed help with. Detectives were very tight-lipped with Michelle's family, but they did provide several key areas for search groups to focus their efforts on. All of them based on the cell phone tower that Michelle's phone pinged during the two-hour window between when Michelle was seen leaving the hospital and when the instructor saw her car return. So while her family is spending all of their efforts on searching for clues, hurt and frustrated that they're being kept in the dark, wondering every day if police are even doing anything to find Michelle, it turned out that the police had a good reason to be so tight-lipped because they had a suspect from day one. Giselle Esteban was one of Michelle's oldest friends. They had gone to high school together in San Diego before both moving to the Bay Area for college. During college, Michelle very briefly dated a guy named Scott Morasigan, so briefly that they only slept together twice. After mutually ending things, Giselle and Scott end up dating a few years later, and she quickly became pregnant with his daughter. They stayed together for about 3 years before things fell apart and they split up. Scott said Giselle was always jealous of his history with Michelle, and it was a big point of tension in their relationship. Giselle didn't want their relationship to end, but it did. And when Giselle learned that Scott was not only maintaining a friendship with Michelle, but also taking their daughter to spend time with her, she accused them of sleeping together during Scott and Giselle's relationship, something that they both denied. But nothing could convince Giselle otherwise. She was fixated on this idea that Michelle had broken up their family, and that effectively ended the girls' friendship. Giselle believed with every fiber of her being that Michelle had ruined her life. Giselle is one of the first people questioned by police because her name was the only one Michelle's family could think of when they asked if they knew of anyone who had a problem with her. But even then, her family didn't think that Giselle was responsible, or even capable of being responsible for that matter. This was an old friend of Michelle's, and the family knew her very, very well. They just believed that they had a falling out and would probably make up eventually. However, when police speak to Giselle, she doesn't even try to hide her animosity. When they tell her they're looking for Michelle, she was like, "I've also been looking for her because I want to tell her to stay away from my daughter." Like, that's
not the time.
That's what she says to the cops.
No.
It's ridiculous. Obviously, that's very suspicious to them, but that doesn't mean that Giselle did anything. You know, it could just mean that she doesn't like this chick.
Yeah, of course.
So detectives continue on. Their next lead came from Michelle's nursing school. When they searched her vehicle, they had found an ID card belonging to an instructor, but not the one who reported her missing. This was somebody else. They found the ID card on the passenger seat, so they go to question this woman. And it turned out the instructor that it belonged to had only just started that job a few days prior to Michelle's disappearance, so she didn't even know Michelle. And on top of that, she reported her ID card missing the same day that Michelle disappeared. So after reviewing the security footage at the school, police are floored. Giselle is seen arriving at the school on May 26th, the day before Michelle disappeared. She pretended to be a prospective student there to tour the school. While she was there, she snagged the ID card off of a desk when no one was looking. The footage shows her leaving, and then after the facility closed down for the night and the school was all dark and empty, Giselle is seen returning, using the ID card to enter because it doubled as a key card. And you see her put on a lab coat and grab a clipboard, and then she wanders the empty, dark school, disguised as an instructor on the off chance that someone catches her. So she's in there for 2 hours, looking through cabinets, desk drawers, and files. And at one point, you see her in a classroom going from computer to computer, turning them on and off. Detectives believe that she was there to try to find Michelle's new home address, but it doesn't appear that she was successful, and eventually she gives up and leaves. Then the following day, something unknown drew Michelle out to her car in a hurry, in the midst of her shift, and she never returns. The day after her disappearance, when everyone is blowing up Michelle's phone, detectives discover that Giselle went to an Apple store and told an employee that her toddler had been messing with her iPhone and accidentally locked it. The security footage from the Apple store is time-stamped, and it shows the employee unlocking and handing it over to Giselle moments before Michelle's family reported receiving the very first text message from Michelle's phone that day. Police then track that for the next several hours, Michelle's phone and Giselle's phone both ping the same phone towers at the same time, suggesting that the phones were together. They then discover security footage of Giselle taking her daughter to a Chuck E. Cheese, where she is seen obsessively texting from an iPhone. And again, the timestamps coincide with all of the timestamps that Michelle's loved ones were receiving weird messages from her phone. Before leaving Chuck E. Cheese, Giselle is seen powering down the iPhone, and that also aligns with the point in which Michelle's phone was turned off. Police then put a tracking device on Giselle's car without her knowledge, and they discover that during that huge vigil Michelle's family held in the days after she disappeared, Giselle didn't attend, but she did continuously circle the park that it was being held in the entire time. It then shows that after the vigil ended, Giselle drove past Scott's house, which might be because Scott attended the vigil. So detectives believe that she circled the vigil to see if Scott was there, and then when she spotted him, that she then followed him home. So just as detectives are preparing to approach Scott to question him, Scott surprises them by reaching out first. He tells police that 4 days before Michelle went missing, he was granted a restraining order against Giselle. He'd woken up in the middle of the night when his car alarm was going off outside. He'd gone out to investigate, but didn't see anything. When he walked back in, he was shocked to see Giselle in his bedroom trying to access his laptop. But the reason that he reached out to police was because after he got home from the vigil, he found Michelle's iPhone in his back seat. He knew how this looked, but he was confident that he could prove that Giselle had planted the phone in his car. For months leading up to Michelle's disappearance, Giselle regularly threatened Scott if he didn't stop seeing Michelle. It didn't matter that he denied seeing her at all. And the threats became so alarming, he started secretly recording their conversations in case anything happened to him.
Very smart.
I asked you, can we just be honest about Michelle? Because she's the one issue that I really, really am having a hard time dealing with.
That's not what you said at
yes.
all.
Okay, we well then fine. Starting from now, we are going to be honest about Michelle. Do you understand me? Okay. Whether you sleep with her, whether you share food with her, whether you talk to her, you will be honest with me. Look at me. You will be honest with me regarding her. Otherwise, I will take your life and hers.
Mom.
And you can take that to the grave with you.
Why?
Why? Because you lied about her so many times, it's hard to believe that you didn't sleep with her and lock her up. You deserve to die for your lies, as does she, and you will. If you do it again, this is your last and final warning.
Why?
Do you understand me?
So that argument was recorded in Scott's car with their daughter, their 3-year-old daughter, in the back seat. Mm-hmm. And if you, I don't know how well the audio is, but if you can hear it well, you can hear her say, When Giselle says, "I will take your life and hers," you can hear her daughter in the background say, "Mommy."
Yeah.
So at the end, when the audio gets bad, Giselle says, "You deserve to die for your lies, as does she. And you will if you do it again. This is your last and final warning." Just gives me the heebie-jeebies.
I know. And at this point, they're separated, correct?
And have been for like at least a year.
So it's literally none of her business what he's even doing.
No, not at all. Ugh. After the meeting with Scott, the forensic report on Michelle's car was completed. So what police discovered but kept from Michelle's family was that there was an enormous amount of Michelle's blood found smeared along the seats, but someone had cleaned it up, making it invisible to the naked eye. They also found Giselle's fingerprints and her hair inside the vehicle. And on top of that, when police questioned Giselle the day after Michelle disappeared, they had asked to take the clothing and items that she admitted to wearing the day before. And after testing, they find spots of Michelle's blood on Giselle's shoes. All of those details are what led police to inform Michelle's family that they believe she had been murdered. But because they didn't have a body yet, they couldn't actually do anything about it, which means they couldn't share those details with her family. But luckily, all of this DNA evidence combined with Scott's experiences end up being more than enough. And 3 months after Michelle disappeared, Giselle Esteban is arrested and charged with her murder. This was a very big deal because at this point, Michelle is still technically missing. Authorities typically need very compelling evidence to get an arrest warrant for a murder where there isn't even a body. Giselle denied the accusations, but 10 days after her arrest, Michelle's skeletal remains were found buried in a shallow grave a few miles away from the hospital. A cause of death was never determined, but authorities were confident that Giselle had lured Michelle out to her car under false pretenses, incapacitated her somehow, and then drove her body to the place that she was buried. They believe she then attempted to return Michelle's car to the parking spot that she had found it at Kaiser, but then was surprised when the nursing instructor flagged her down and started approaching, which is why the vehicle backs up quickly and peels out of the parking garage. The prosecution's opening arguments in Giselle's murder trial was stellar, but it turned out to be all for nothing because Giselle went on to admit to killing Michelle. She claimed it was in the heat of the moment and she hadn't planned on hurting her. However, that isn't true. During the trial, when Giselle's face is plastered all over the local news as the woman charged with Michelle's murder, a Catholic priest approached the police. He said the day that Michelle disappeared, Giselle approached him as he stood outside of his church in Hayward. She started to ask for forgiveness, and he stopped her and told her that they should go inside to the confessional. She cut him off and said, "No, it's okay, we can stay out here." And she goes on to ask for forgiveness for something that she hasn't yet done. He asked her again if she would like to go into the confessional to have this conversation, and again she declined. What she didn't realize is that by choosing to stay outside, everything she said was not considered privileged information. So apparently whatever you say in a confessional is confidential, and that's regardless of what you say. Regardless of what you say, the priest isn't legally obligated to go to authorities. But because she repeatedly turned down his suggestion to go inside, and then 4 hours later Michelle went missing, the priest was legally within his right to go to the police and share what he knew. Giselle was found guilty and sentenced to 25 years to life in prison. She had been 3 months pregnant when she murdered Michelle, and she ended up giving birth in prison. The father of that child has custody today. Michelle's family was absolutely devastated to learn who was responsible for taking her from them, because Michelle had always been a patient and loyal friend to Giselle, even agreeing to attend therapy sessions with her as a way to mend their friendship. They don't believe that Michelle really grasped the level of obsessive hate that Giselle had for her, evidenced by the very last text that Michelle ever sent to Giselle. It read, quote, "No matter what, you'll always be my friend." Her determination to be a good friend and then to believe the best in people made the fact that she was murdered for something she hadn't even done all the more tragic. Michelle's brother Michael, as well as several of her family members, continue to volunteer with the Klass Kids Foundation. Just like Mark Klass, they are determined to be there helping and providing support to families who are experiencing the nightmare that they've been through too. And that is the story of Michelle Lay's murder.
So let me get this straight. So Michelle and Giselle were friends.
In high school.
And then they just basically went on to date the same person just at different times. Basically. Michelle dated him first.
Yeah.
Then Giselle did. And then Giselle was just always wary of Michelle.
Yeah, she was always jealous of the history that Scott and Michelle had, even though it was so brief and like more of a fling than anything.
Yeah.
And then technically, I mean, because the girls were friends, that's how Giselle met Scott. And then a couple of years after Michelle and Scott had that little fling in college, Giselle and Scott get together and she immediately gets pregnant. They go on to have a long-term relationship. I think they were engaged, but she just always had this issue with the history there. She was always envious. She was always jealous. And like Michelle's a Libra and she's like so bubbly and beautiful. She's so beautiful and just
social and fun.
It's just easy to be envious of someone like that if you're insecure.
Everyone has a past, okay?
Yeah, everybody.
Everyone has a past. You cannot... For me, it's to be smart enough to break into ultimately a nursing school.
Yeah.
Take a lab coat, steal a pass, go through the halls, mimic a professor or an instructor.
Yeah.
But then not have the wherewithal of doing all of these things like texting in public where there's surveillance. It's like for there to be so much intelligence in one aspect and then really lacking in the other. But I guess that is mental illness.
Definitely. That's one of the wildest parts of this whole story is like the level of security footage.
Oh yeah.
It's insane. It feels like almost every inch of this whole thing was caught on camera with the exception of Michelle's car was parked directly below a security camera in the parking garage, and that one camera wasn't working.
And then there was that, like, the 22 minutes where...
You don't know what happened for 22 minutes in that window.
Everything else is documented.
Yep.
That was an insane story.
Yeah.
Thank you so much for telling it.
Thank you for listening.
Anytime. Love you.
Love you.
Bye. Bye. If you enjoyed this episode, please rate, review, and subscribe wherever you enjoy listening. We owe everything to the many journalists, authors, filmmakers, psychiatrists, and psychologists whose extensive work and expertise we pulled from to share this episode with you. To view detailed source material, as well as content from today, please visit us on Instagram and TikTok at Shorty's Podcast. We really love doing this show, and if you'd like to help with the continued creation of it, you can support by donating to our Patreon, patreon.com/Shorty's Podcast. This episode was hosted by Ashley Brumley Johnson and Anika Tharina.